Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with mystery writer Greg Herron, whose most recent novel is Hurricane Season Hustle, a Scotty Bradley mystery. We'll also hear from longtime library activist Shannon Svetanovich, the new executive director of the Public Library Foundation of New Orleans. Greg Herron may well be the most prolific author and editor in New Orleans. He's written 33 novels, including Murder in the Rue Charters, which won the prestigious Lambda Literary Award. He's edited several anthologies, including Love, Bourbon Street, Reflections on New Orleans. He's also written more than 50 short stories, edited several anthologies, edited books for several publishers, as well as serving as a fitness columnist and book reviewer. All this in addition to his demanding day job as a public health researcher for Crescent Care, formerly the No AIDS Task Force. His most recent book is perfect for June reading, both because it's Pride Month and the start of New Orleans' dreaded fifth season, hurricane season. The latest in the Scotty Bradley series is called Hurricane Season Hustle. Well, Greg Herron, hello. I would just go on, but I thought I better let you talk.
How are you, Susan? It's good to see you.
Good, darling. So remind us of who Scotty Bradley is and why you keep returning to him.
Nobody will let him die. I still get asked about the Chance books, when I'm going to do another Chance book, and that's been 12 years since I ended that series. Scotty just seems to have a life of his own. I just never really have anything planned for that series. If I get a good idea for it, if I can come up with something interesting that I've not done before with him, I'll do it. I just don't put any limits on him. I also don't put any expectations. That's why it can go years between books in the series. I'll suddenly realize, oh, I haven't done a Scotty book in like 3 years, have I? And so then I start looking through the idea folder. This was the book I was going to write after Mardi Gras Mambo.
Oh, really? That's a long time.
This was the proposal I sent in with the manuscript for Mardi Gras Mambo in August of 2005.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was literally like 2 weeks before Katrina, I turned it in. And one of the first emails I sent after evacuating was to my editor, and I just said, I don't think I can write that book now.
It's a long time to get back to it, though.
Yeah, and so I've had that idea for a long, 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 long time, and it's evolved a lot from what it was originally going to be. It was originally going to be set during an evacuation in the city when no one's here, because I thought that would be really a lot of fun. And the main case was going to be I wanted to do a man in the velvet mask kind of thing. So I wanted to have somebody whose face has been damaged and always wore masks and never left their house. I thought that would be a lot of fun. And remembering back to that time, there's so many things I've forgotten about this series that I wanted to do with it and what I was thinking when I first started writing it. But I was thinking in terms of the Three Musketeers because I had the three guys.
Right.
That just naturally led me to the Man in the Iron Mask, which is my favorite story. And so I wanted to do something with somebody who always wore a mask on their face. Moonlighting did a great episode years and years and years ago with a woman who was acid face and had to wear veils all the time and had a very scratchy throat and talked like this. It was one of my favorite episodes of Moonlighting. And I loved Moonlighting, and it's influenced me a lot more than I probably realize or I've ever talked about.
So an homage would not be out of place.
Yeah, it's very different. I mean, the book that I eventually wrote off of that idea is very different than what I originally envisioned it to be. Of course, at the time, I had been through several evacuations and I had ridden through several storms, but it never occurred to me to write during, to set the story during the hurricane. While you're writing this hurricane out, I thought that would be an interesting thing to do, where it was kind of like creating a locked room thing where everyone's...
With weather.
The weather has everyone contained. John D. MacDonald wrote a really great book called Murder in the Wind that was set during a hurricane arrival in Florida, on the coast of Florida. And it was one of my favorite books. And I was thinking, you know, pulling from that idea too, I was like, yeah, that was really cool. I really liked how that worked. So I found a ridiculously expensive copy of that paperback on eBay and read it again. It's really quite good. John D. MacDonald is known for Travis McGee, but his novels, standalone novels, were phenomenal.
Well, since this is a locked room version, describe the landscape, because it is so enchanting and mysterious.
That was the fun thing about, I based the house on a real house, in the real property, and I was trying at first, when I was writing the book, trying to enclose it all exactly as the property was, which is really stupid. And then I realized, it's fiction, you can make stuff up, Greg. It was really fun doing that house. I added a floor to it. The main house has an extra floor than the real house does. And there's not a dower house on the real house property. It's that one that's across the street from Anne Rice's old house. I found pictures of the interior online, the inside. And so I went off of that a little bit, like with the staircase and the windows that were, had those weird cross lattice work on them and all of that.
You know, it occurs to me that houses have always been important to you. You were in love with Rebecca and Manderley, you know?
Oh, well, you know, I've always I kind of wanted to make it, give it a touch of that Gothic thing too, mm-hmm. that Gothic sensibility. Whenever you're writing about a big house, big old house, especially in New Orleans, it's got to be kind of Gothic-y anyway, because there's so much history and so many ghosts in every house here. And I wanted to play with that a lot. I've never really talked about what Scotty's relationship was like with the rest of his mother's family when he was younger, and memories of growing up in that house. And I realized that he's never really there very often. I don't think he's ever set foot in his grandparents' house in a book before until now. I could be wrong. But I wanted to make that a thing where he's always felt uncomfortable. You know, he has that psychic ability too. And so that house is just always, there's just so much tragedy and death and horrible stuff that's happened in that house over the years that it always affects him. But he doesn't, I meant to put that, write that into the book. I don't remember if I did. I should have read the book again.
That's one of the things that one of the characters points out about Garden District mansions, that nobody really knows their entire past, that terrible things have happened people don't know about.
Yeah, well, most of the houses in the Garden District don't belong to the original owners anymore either, mm-hmm. I don't think. And that was one of the things that is fervent in the series, is that Scotty's grandparents, that's the family's original house in New Orleans. That is, they've always owned and lived in that house after they left the French Quarter. I mean, I have their whole family history in my head.
Now, the other thing about this book that is so interesting and gives it weight is that the roots of the crime, the reasons for the crime, go way back into New Orleans history, which is important to you.
Yes. One of the things that I've been grappling with the Scotty character and his family for like the last 5 or 6 years, which is really kind of shameful that it never occurred to me before. It's like, he's ridiculously privileged. He is ridiculously privileged. And I didn't know. And when I originally would talk about where his family money comes from, I was just going by Louisiana, what old money in Louisiana, how did their money come from? And then it didn't dawn on me that, yes, they were a wealthy French and Creole family in New Orleans in this 18th century. Where did they get their money from? It's like, how do you deal? How would somebody like Scotty and his mom deal with knowing that your money comes from, and like the money that they have now, oil companies, petrochemical companies, all these things that they're very against in their everyday lives, but this is what's paying for your life. So it's like when you start looking into the past history of the family and what they've done and what companies they've owned or owned a huge percentage of have done, how do you wrap your mind around that? How do you cope with that? And that's something, part of the reason why I wanted to make this book so specialized, so, you know, so compact and in such a small time period and so quick, because I hadn't figured that out yet. I hadn't figured out how they would handle that yet. And so I said, well, I'll just put it off for another book and figure it out.
Well, you've written so much now. What are you most proud of in all the books you've written? You've just done so many different types of things.
I'm actually really proud of the body of work. When I first started writing, I was told by several people that I had to decide what kind of books I wanted to write. And that was what I would write for the rest of my life. And it's like, I don't want to just write one kind of book for the rest of my life. And Sue Grafton told me once that as much as she loved writing Kinsey and how much she loved the huge success she had with Kinsey, sometimes she wanted to write something else, but nobody wanted it. And I thought, that's a beautiful gold cage you're in there. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, I can see how frustrating and that would feel as a writer, not being able to write something that you really want to do because nobody wants it. You're one of the biggest selling authors of all time in your field.
If I were you, I think I would be really proud of the books I'd written for young readers.
I'm proud of all of them, really, for different reasons. Probably my favorite book is what I call the Alabama book. It's Bury Me in Shadows is my favorite book that I've written personally, because that turned out exactly the way I wanted it to when I started writing it. And that's something I'm very, very proud of. I'm one of those people who's never completely satisfied.
Yeah.
But just has to stop because there's no more time. And that was one where I really felt like there's nothing I could do to make that book better than what it is. I'm very, very proud of that book and for the issues it addressed. And I'm very proud of the Kansas book for the issues it addressed. And I'm very proud of the fact that I can write so many different things and that I'm not restricted to just writing Scotty books or Chance books or just doing that. I really am very appreciative of the fact that I've gotten to explore and have fun, which is really, really important.
And give pleasure to readers.
Yeah. And so now I'm back to enjoying it again, finally. I'm finally healthy again, and I'm enjoying writing again. And who knows, I might be writing ridiculous amounts of work again.
Woo!
But you never know. Stranger things have happened.
Well, I'm very proud to know you, Mr. Heron.
Thank you, Susan. I'm proud to know you, too.
All righty. We've been talking with Greg Heron, whose most recent book is Hurricane Season Hustle, a Scotty Bradley Mystery. Greg, thank you so much.
Thanks, Susan.
Yannis Vodanovich is one of the most dedicated literacy and library activists I know. Whether it's passing on the word about a good book she's just read, teaching an adult literacy class as she has for many years, or serving as executive director of the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library, as she did for the past 4 years. She is one of the individuals who brightens and sustains our literary community. And today we're talking about an exciting new chapter, not just for Shannon, but for the entire New Orleans Public Library system. Shannon Svetanovich, welcome.
Thank you, Susan. So glad to be with you.
It's always a treat to see you. Now, you have been the executive director of the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library for 4 years. And
correct.
Now you're taking on an important new role. So tell us about that.
Yes. So I am the executive director of a new organization that was founded from the merger of the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library and the New Orleans Public Library Foundation. Susan, a lot of friends and foundations in the library world across the country are merging. There's a lot of confusion if you have two different groups that are trying to raise money for the library. So if you don't know to which organization you should write the check, you probably won't write one. So in an effort to be more clear and to give the public an easier way to support the library that they love, we have merged to form one organization, which is called the Library Foundation of New Orleans. And our purpose is in the name. We are there to support the public library of the city of New Orleans, especially when it comes to programming that people enjoy, you know, every day that they go to the library.
Now, those two organizations in New Orleans have had a tangled history.
Correct. It has been a long history. So the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library was founded in 1957. And like most Friends groups across the country, they tended to be all volunteer run and very grassroots. Moving forward into the 90s, we saw a proliferation of library foundations pop up around the country to professionalize fundraising for library purposes. And that's exactly what happened in New Orleans when the New Orleans Public Library Foundation was established. Unfortunately, several years ago, the New Orleans Public Library Foundation was involved in some serious financial mismanagement. And as a result, has lain dormant for the past few years in terms of fundraising. The Friends of the Library, though, in the absence of the New Orleans Public Library Foundation, kept going, kept fundraising, taking on more grants, taking on more work. And so it was decided between the board of the Friends of the Library and the New Orleans Public Library Foundation that we would get together and work on merging the two to create one solid organization to support the libraries.
But that took a long time. Why did it take 2 years?
Well, you know, I think to do anything well, it's going to take a while. And I want to give credit to the board of the New Orleans Public Library Foundation. You know, after the financial mismanagement and challenges that they had, to put it mildly, they did have a new board that came on to preserve the assets that they had and to give a gift to the library every year. So over the past few years, even though the old New Orleans Public Library Foundation was not actively raising money, it was still giving a good chunk of funds to the library to purchase books for giveaways and things like that. But obviously, Susan, that's not sustainable. To give money away, you have to be raising money. So what we decided to do was to come together, pool our assets and our expertise to form the one organization. But as I said, to do anything well, it takes time. You know, these are two companies that are coming together, and we wanted to make sure we had all of our legal I's dotted and T's crossed. And so it took the time it took. And we appreciate most of all the Greater New Orleans Foundation, this merger. I cannot say enough about them and the work they did.
How were the board members selected?
So we have our board members from the Friends are staying on as the board members of the Library Foundation of New Orleans. The board chair of the New Orleans Public Library Foundation is coming on for a year to help us with the transition. And one of the things that we're working on over the next few months with our consultant is recruiting new board members to join us. You know, people who are eager to not only help us raise funds for the library, but to be advocates for the library, to speak up for the library when it's needed. So that is coming in the next few months, is, you know, looking for people who are willing to do some service for the library, you know, people who have a real passion for the library. And as I said, who aren't afraid to speak up in support of the library when it's needed. You know, the library, I think sometimes we take it for granted. It's always there. And it never hurts to remind our elected officials and people around us that the library is so critical to people in this town. I see that every day when I go to the main library and I see how many people come in the doors, just what a critical resource it is for people.
It's the one part of government where it's win-win. Everybody goes and gets what they need, you know?
That's, no, I think you're right. I hear that from a lot of people who say that the library is the one governmental entity that they still trust completely.
Yeah.
And I think the librarians feel that very keenly. They take their work seriously. You know, I can see the investments that the library is making right now, for example, in facilities. You know, I'm very proud of the library that it has taken on the tremendous job to replace roofs at 5 of their branches, you know, across the city, because without branches, we do not have programs. So they are moving forward. They have gone into their own reserve fund to put these roofs on the buildings where they need to be. You know, they take it seriously. They want people in the building. And I'm very proud to work hand in hand with them to raise money, as I always say, to make the librarians' dreams come true. Whatever they want, whatever programs they want to try, we want to help support that.
Now, what are some of the other early priorities you set for this group?
So for us, I mean, one of my priorities is going to be, one, obviously, increasing the number of board members. Number two, I think for us, it is revising our policies that we have in place in terms of donations, just to make it easier for people to donate, you know, whether it's just, you know, if you want to make a small $10 gift or a larger bequest, I want to make sure that that's easy for anybody to do. But I think the biggest thing, Susan, is I want to encourage the librarians and library administration to think big about what they would like from us in the future. When I talk to library staff, sometimes I'm reminded of my mom, who was a school teacher, and friends of mine who are school teachers, who seem sometimes hesitant to ask for a lot. They worry about spending money. They take spending any dollars very seriously. But I want them to think big and let us know what programs would they like to try out, even if it's a pilot program. You know, for example, we had a great success with our early literacy librarians. A librarian named Shaniqua Gilmore came to us and said, I'd like to start doing some early literacy story times for neurodivergent children. Can you help me with that? I thought, fantastic idea. Happy to pay for that, pay for the books, pay for whatever materials you need. And it's turned out to be a great success. And so I'm just looking for more of that, for librarians to come up with ideas. What do they hear from the public? What is needed? And let us help fund that. I just want to make sure they're thinking big, though, because I know it's easy to just say, to be hesitant and to think we don't have enough money. But I'd rather if they think big and let us worry about raising the money for it. We want to hear some big ideas that can enhance the library system.
And of course, the book sales will go on, which is one way that people know the library, friends.
Susan, if we did not have the book sales, the book sales are so important to us. Not only are they raising money for the library, not only are they recycling books, you know, and putting them back into people's hands, but they're an inexpensive way to fill up, you know, your bookshelf. When I look at what new books cost, particularly for small children, I mean, I just don't know, how do you manage to have a robust library for a child with prices the way they are? So we sell very inexpensively at our Carriage House bookstore behind the Ladder Library, but we're also committed to doing pop-up book sales around the city. You know, that is not going to change. You know, for a long time, I think the Friends focused very much on book sales that were uptown at the Carriage House in one spot. But in the past year, we've purchased a cargo van. So we're taking the show on the road and having, you know, pop-up sales, whether in Gentilly or Lakeview.
Now, do y'all have the website up yet? Or are you working?
The website is up. It is support, LFNO. So support Library Foundation New Orleans. And we are working on the website, just adding things to it all the time. But you can find us at support, LFNO. Any donation can be made there. And if anyone has any questions for me, they can reach out to us through the website. We would love to talk to people.
And I'm sure you would love volunteers.
Always. We can always use volunteers. And honestly, a lot of the volunteer work that we can use is around our pop-up book sales. As I always tell people, these books don't lift themselves. And so Getting help to lift and to pack up after the sale can be a challenge. So we can always use that kind of help, and honestly, just an easy way to help us out is when you see social media come out about a book sale, share it with people, tell people about it. The more you spread the word, the better it is for us.
Great. Well, congratulations and thank you so much for all you do, Shannon.
Thank you, Susan. I love talking to you, and I'm just looking forward to more years supporting the public library that we all love.
Here's what's on tap this week in the literary life. Middle grade author Angèle Terrell reads from her new book, Archie Dare and the Pirate Code, Saturday, June 13th at 11 a.m. at Gardner Dietrich Bookshop. Daniel Squadron signs his new book, The Fourth Branch, How State Government Can Save Our Union, and appears in conversation with Tim Miller, Monday, June 15th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Wallow 267 discusses and signs Yes to You, No to Them, Thursday, June 18th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. This is a ticketed event. Local author Kathy Chapetta Spice will discuss and sign her new book, The Faith of New Orleans, at 7 p.m. Tuesday, June 23rd at the East Bank Regional Library.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.